Welcome back to Coast, everyone. I'm George Knapp in for the vacationing George Norrie. We've got prediction shows this week on Coast to Coast. Art going to be here tonight and the next night, and then Ian on New Year's Day. We're going to do sort of our own predictions, although it's less about what's coming as opposed to how to get ready for it. Matt Stein is an engineer, outdoorsman, has a lot of talents. He wrote a book called When Technology Fails, and he's our guest for the rest of the program. Matt, you there? Is Matt Stein with us?
Hear me.
Hey, I can hear you now. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Let's start this way. We are at the end of the year, getting ready to go into a new year. I'm kind of curious about how you see things happening. You know, in your book, you talk about various scenarios that might be coming down the road. Which ones do you think are coming down the road, and when?
Well, I think in the next year, in my mind, there's no question that the economy is going to continue to dive for a while. There's some chance that Obama will pull this off in terms of starting to turn it around, but it's not going to be anything anyone can snap their fingers and turn around quickly. My guess is that it's going to dive pretty badly, and it's going to take something along the lines of what Roosevelt did in the Depression. But Obama's got the right idea that what really remains to be seen is, can he fight big business and big oil? Can he really rebuild America in sustainable directions and get off the oil habit? And, you know, that remains to be seen whether he's successful at actually doing it. You know, there's a lot of people that say they're going to do it, but there's a huge amount of power and momentum to keep us hooked on oil. So if he can truly get us going in the right direction, then I think in, you know, 1 to 2 years, 3 years, you might see things starting to turn around. But it's going to be pretty rough until that happens. And if he's not successful, then you're going to see everything really collapse.
Okay, well, let's talk about some scenarios on the economic front then. I mean, how bad could it get? How soon could it get that bad?
Well, when the Soviet Union came in 1991, I believe, the Politburo came in to work on Christmas Day and dissolved the Soviet Union. And instantaneously, the rubles were worthless. The economy collapsed. And people got by with the black market and on trading. And at least in the Soviet Union, when things collapsed, you know, the power stayed on. Public transportation still ran. Not too many people were starving. They got by in their kitchen gardens. They'd been used to a system that hadn't been working well for years, so they didn't have very far to go, and they were used to kind of getting by and doing the best they could. Now, imagine in America, I mean, we all know what happened when Enron went down, when MCI, you know, the huge telecom company went down. Those doors got closed. They were boarded up. Nothing works. When you don't pay your mortgage payment, or you don't pay your gas bill, they turn it off. So in America, I think if things really fell apart like that, then we'd be in much more serious shape than the Soviet Union was, because we don't have that kind of public infrastructure that runs whether or not there's private money funding it. You know, it just kind of kept going even if people weren't getting paid. We don't do that way in America.
You're saying if we had that kind of an economic collapse, I mean, what would happen for most American families? How would they handle it?
What would happen for most American families is they wouldn't be able to put gas in their car. They wouldn't have power or water in their homes. If they were still allowed to be in their homes, nothing is working. You know, you would see a situation where people were dependent totally on kitchen gardens, and most of Americans don't do that. And you'd see panic all over. You know, it would be, that's a situation where having your skills in line before that happens is so important. Like in the Great Depression, money just kind of went away, and people banded together and worked together. Neighbors helped each other. In some cases, they'd get together whenever they were going to foreclose on a farm, and all the neighbors would get together, bring their rifles, and the cops would just get turned around and leave. They couldn't kick them off their farms. So if America stays complacent, then you'll find that they're just not ready for that kind of situation like the Depression. And so it could be really tough. And that's why knowledge is power. You want to have those skills. You want to have some basic materials so you can garden. So you've got some portable structures, kind of camping equipment, that if you need to leave your home for whether it's a disaster or a terrorist act, or just simply that nothing's working in your locale and you've got to hoof it down the road, to have those skills and those materials so you can do that is just common sense. And it's like car insurance. You know, nobody drives down the freeway and says, I think I want to get into a head-on collision today. You know, you have that insurance, and you just hope to God and you never need it. And you thank God you had it if that day comes when you get into a wreck and you need that insurance. And having these skills and having these basic materials on hand is like that car insurance. You hope to God that you never need it, and if a day does come when you need it, you thank God you had it.
Terrorist threat is one of the scenarios you talk about in the book. How likely is something like that? I mean, it doesn't have to be an all-out 9/11. It could be something smaller that could be disruptive, a dirty bomb somewhere.
Well, a dirty bomb, I think, is, yeah, that's certainly a possibility. And there's so many nuclear weapons in the world. And, you know, let's face it, if you're a Soviet guard that wasn't paid, like when the Soviet Union collapsed and you weren't paid for a long period of time, and somebody came along and basically you could live easy for the rest of your life if you just turned your head the other direction while some armed men came in and wandered off with a nuclear weapon. You know, those are significant possibilities. I mean, I hope it never happens, but chances are good it's going to happen one of these days somewhere in our world. And, you know, look what just happened in India and Mumbai. That's not a dirty bomb. That's not an actual suitcase nuke. That's just some well-organized guys with automatic weapons and grenades. And certainly there's no reason that couldn't happen in our country, and I hope it never does happen again.
Matt, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some other scenarios you describe in the book and how we can get ready for them. We're talking with Matt Stein, author of When Technology Fails, here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Knapp, in tonight for the vacationing George Norrie. We're talking with Matthew Stein, an engineer who wrote a book called When Technology Fails. And Matt, I guess the title is sort of indicative, when technology fails, not if it fails. You think it's going to happen?
I think it's going to happen. I think that we have technology's always failing. I mean, we're seeing nuclear plants coming close to meltdown. Or actually, we had, you know, Three Mile Island came close to becoming a Chernobyl. It was 3 days after Three Mile Island had its near meltdown. You know, it did go crazy inside the container, but it didn't end up like Chernobyl. But that was just a stroke of luck. I mean, for 3 days, the scientists really didn't know whether it was going to blow its top like Chernobyl or whether it was going to stay contained like it did. So technology is always failing to some degree. It really depends on how well we manage our future, whether it's going to just out-and-out collapse or whether we're going to make a shift to sustainability and kind of find our way through a new renaissance in the world. And, you know, at the latter part of the show, I'd like to talk about how we can do that. But I want to go back to this terror threat for a minute. As long as we are tied to Israel, and as long as we do not pressure Israel into making a peaceful solution, like the prime minister of Israel that's going out of power, he's been a hawk all these years, and he's basically finally said, you know, we just have to make concessions, and we just have to get out of the occupied lands, and we have to make peace. Now, why he didn't do that when he had the power to actually make that happen, and why he's saying that now when he's, like, getting out of power, that's kind of beyond me. But as long as we don't make that happen, I mean, Jimmy Carter was so close in helping that to happen. And when Rabin got shot, you know, they were right on the verge, and hawks within the Israeli government and people in the military, you know, teamed up and assassinated their leader because he was really close to making a deal with the Palestinians for peace. As long as we don't get that peace, And we're going to be drawing the wrath of the radical elements in the Muslim world.
Well, the point is well taken, Matt. But I'll tell you, if our security and safety depends on there being a lasting peace in the Middle East, man, it's time to stock up on ammo and beans.
Well, you know, I'm just saying, you're talking about terrorism. We don't, you know, we're the main people who are funding this country. And they see us as like, they're the people who are funding this country. And, you know, so we're the bad guys in those radical elements' eyes. And it's something, I mean, it's called compromise. Nobody is going to be happy with this solution, but we don't get a solution. And it's only a matter of time before all that money that's funded by our oil habit, you know, manages to buy itself some nuclear weapons, and they end up on our shores, and all hell breaks loose. So, you know, that's the terrorist thing. And certainly India and Pakistan, I mean, we got nothing to do with that. And that same kind of element right there, you know, is just waiting to launch some, get their hands on some nukes, because the governments on both sides have the nukes. All it takes is somebody losing their cool, and they start throwing them back and forth, and who knows what's going to happen as a result of that.
All right, let's talk about one of the scenarios you mentioned, and you just touched on oil. You mentioned about peak oil and what that could mean to the economy, to the world, to people here in their homes sitting listening to this program. Describe the scenario. And I ask it in this context, is that we just saw oil prices drop from over $4 a gallon down to, you know, like $1.66 in most places, and it I don't know that that's an ultimate solution or it's going to last, but it sure suggests that something is going on in the market that's the reverse of what you're predicting, doesn't it?
Well, it's a short-term thing, and actually, like Richard Heinberg and others who studied peak oil for ages have said that it's only natural you're going to see fluctuations. What we saw was that when oil went up to $160 a barrel, that it started to collapse the world's economy. And these people who are selling the oil, well, you know, they depend on that oil to support their lavish lifestyles and to support their governments. You know, in fact, the government of Mexico depends on oil for 50% of its operating funds. So imagine now, in 3 years' time, the Cantrell oil fields, like one of five giant oil fields in the world. I mean, Saudi Arabia has Big Gawar, that's another giant field, and Cantrell in Mexico is a giant field. Well, that field is depleting right now. It's something like 25% per year. And in 3 years' time, Mexico is going to go from an oil exporter to an oil importer. Now, that means in 3 years' time, the government of Mexico is going to be totally broke because half of their income will be gone. Now, the Soviet Union, people say, I'm talking about these because these are going to lead up to what's happening in our ballpark. People say that it was Ronald Reagan and the military buildup that collapsed the Soviet Union, but it was oil that collapsed the Soviet Union. What happened is the Soviet Union had a very old, antiquated, poorly run oil business, and it was the oil income that provided the cash that kept the Soviet Union going. Now, after the oil embargo, when we drilled oil like crazy all over the world, we drilled the North Sea, we drilled Indonesia, we drilled Alaska, we drilled in Africa, we drilled all these places over the world outside of the Arab oil nations so that we could drive the oil price down. Well, the oil price collapsed worldwide, kind of like it just did in the last few months. And what that did to the Soviet Union was it bankrupted them because they'd been living off that oil income, and now all of a sudden oil dropped so low that it cost them as much to make the oil and pump the oil as they could sell it for. So their cash flow just went away, bang, zero, bankrupt, just like it's going to happen in Mexico. Now, what's happening in our country and around the world is that when oil prices rose, we started bankrupting our businesses because they were spending everything, like the airlines were going broke. Everyone's going broke because their operating costs all of a sudden tripled. They were based on oil and energy. So the people who depend on that oil income, like the Soviet Union did, now that the oil has dropped, they're in trouble. Soviet Union was in fat city a few months ago when the oil was high. Now they're kind of in trouble. Now, what does that mean for us? Okay, It means short term, it looks great. It's like, ah, peak oil was a lie. Oil prices came down. It was just oil speculators drove the price up. Life is good again, right? Wrong. Problem is that right now, the International Energy Agency, last year, or this year, 2008, they published their figures. Now, this is the people that for years have made these nice little charts that all the governments have planned their future on. And it said, oh, you know, oil demand is going up at 10% a year worldwide, and oil production is going up at 10% a year worldwide. And we'll just go all the way out for like 30 years in the future, and we're going to meet increasing world demand by pumping more oil. Well, problem is, the world's oil fields, the big ones, were discovered mostly back in the 1960s and earlier, and they're all like old, and they're not pumping very well anymore. So the IEA finally did some real hard data and said, oh, maybe it's not, maybe we can't just keep projecting out to the future like we've been. What's happening now is the world's oil fields are depleting at 9.1% per year, unless, except for where they go out and they do what's called enhanced oil recovery, EOR, where they like pump seawater into the ground and help force the oil back out by pumping water in to pump the oil up. So when they do that, then they get 6.4% per year. Now, what does that mean? That means that from now until doomsday, so long as we stay hooked on oil, we've got to find the equivalent of another Saudi Arabia every 1 to 2 years in the world for now and forever. And it just ain't going to happen. I mean, back in 1960s, the discovery of the world's oil, new oil fields, peaked. So for the last 5 years, they've been spending more money looking for oil than that oil was worth. And we've been discovering oil at a rate of one-seventh of what we're using it. So in other words, we're using oil 6 times faster than, with all the money in the world and all the high tech in the world, we're only able to find one-sixth as much oil each year as we use each year. So that means, and you know, the other side of the coin is now that oil prices are low, well, what that means is that the money has dried up to go out and develop those fields that we've already found in the last few years, those ones I spent all that money to find. Well, now the money just dried up to go out and sink wells into those new places they've discovered, the few places they've discovered that are worth drilling in. Now they don't even have the money to go out and drill. And the other thing that's happened is world regular black gold, black oil that's easy to refine, it actually peaked in world production in around 2005, 2006. So for the last 3 years, we've kind of kept the world's production of oil and oil equivalents pretty much flat. And we've done that by putting our money into biofuels and tar sands. Now, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of money to develop and refine tar sands, like in Alberta and in Venezuela, way more than pumping regular oil. But oil's been so high priced the last few years that it made worthwhile to develop biofuels and worthwhile to do what needed to be done to process tar sands. Well, now all of a sudden, oil prices have dropped. So what we've got is
Hey, Matt, we're
we've
going to
got
have
a
to take a
crisis
short.
coming up, and
We're
it's going to keep
Matt, we're going to
staying
take
up.
a short break. Hold on a second. We'll come back and we'll get away from the doom and gloom scenarios and get into some practical advice on how you and your family can get ready for whatever is coming down the pike. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Matthew Stein, author of a book called When Technology Fails, some very practical advice for how to get ready for whatever might be coming our way in 2009. And when we come back after this break, we'll get into specific suggestions on how to get ready. Stay with us. Engineer Matt Stein wrote a book called When Technology Fails. It contains some very specific advice on how to get ready for a variety of different challenges that might be heading our way. Matt, let's start off with what's the most important thing that somebody can do, a family can do to get ready right off the bat?
Well, you want to be ready for the short-term emergency, and that's where a grab-and-run kit is, or a 72-hour emergency kit is so important. You don't want to be stuck like those people around Hurricane Katrina who were waiting for the government to come in and bail them out, or like the people in Japan when the earthquake struck Kobe. And it's, you know, Japan prided themselves as being the most earthquake-prepared country in the world. And when an event the size of Kobe hits, you know, all of the authorities are struck just as bad as all the rest of the people, and everything just fell apart. And it was 9 days before a lot of people got food or water, emergency gear. So you really have to be prepared to do that on your own and defend for yourself and your family, and you team up with your neighbors. You know, one of the best things about crisis is it usually brings out the best in people and not the worst. You know, the media focuses on the looting and the, you know, the thug faction, the crime faction. But for the most part, you see the opposite. You see people pulling together, reaching out their hand to their neighbor, helping people out and bringing out the best in people. So you want to be ready for that, and you want to have a grab and run kit. Now, what does a grab and run kit have? That's kind of like your basic survival kit for minimum of 3 days for you and your family. And the most important thing in a grab and run kit is something to deal with water. Most of us can live a month without food. You may not believe it, you may not like it, you may not feel good, but most of us would survive at least a month without food. But without water, if it's hot weather, in a single day, you're going to be in serious trouble, and you're probably going to be dead in 3 days. So water is critical. I was climbing El Capitan in Yosemite in 1984, probably the start of global warming, but, you know, nobody was talking about global warming back then, but it was record hot. I mean, we woke up at 6 in the morning, 2,000 feet off the ground, climbing in our shorts. And when the sun got high, it was over 100 degrees. And when my partner had asked me a question, I'd try to answer, and it was horrible. I mean, my tongue would stick like super glue to the roof of my mouth, and I'd start gagging and retching when I just tried to answer a simple question. We climbed through the night with our headlamps on, found the nearest mud puddle when we got off the top of El Capitan, 3,000 feet high off the ground, and we stuck our faces in that mud puddle and drunk. Now, if you're in that situation and you're not prepared, no matter, you're going to end up drinking from the most disgusting, scummy duck pond or ditch water if that's all you got to drink out of. So in your grab and run kit, you want to have good chemicals in a good backcountry filter for purifying water, so you and your family can take scummy ditch water, pump it through this backcountry filter, and it comes out sweet, clean tasting, and safe. Doesn't make you sick. That's the most important thing in there. I have a list in my book and on my website at www.wentechfails.com. I have a list of about 25 items you should have in your grab and run kit, but I'll give you some of the most important ones right here. So water filter is most important. Obviously, you want to have something like a multi-tool knife, a Leatherman or a Swiss Army knife in there. One of the things that I find that is so important, it's never in my grab and run kit because I'm always using it, is my headlamp. I've got a backcountry type LED headlamp. So if you need to work on your car at night, you know, you strap the headlamp on your head. It's got lightweight batteries. The LEDs are very durable, not like traditional light bulbs. They don't break. And it lasts a long time on four AA batteries. And it leaves your hands free. So the headlamp points the light wherever you point. And it's waterproof, totally waterproof. Very important thing. I use mine like all the time. First aid kit with cloth tape. I always have an ACE bandage and a roll of 1.5 inch cloth tape to supplement my lightweight first aid kit. And then I've got a really big kit that I could stitch up legs with if I had to, stitch up wounds if I had to. And that goes in my box that I can throw in my car. But if I'm sticking this on my back, I can't take my giant first aid kit with me. I've got just a little small lightweight one supplemented with an ACE bandage in case someone sprains an ankle, or you can bind a wound up with it, and cloth tape. Now, why cloth tape? Well, if you're not used to walking, you start if all of a sudden you have to leave your car behind, there's no gas, or maybe the bridges are out and the car's worthless because you can't get across creeks because the bridges are gone, you're not used to walking, chances are you're going to blister up in about a mile, and then you're not going anywhere. So you take this 1.5 inch cloth tape, and as soon as you're heels start feeling sore before the blisters get there and pop. You know, you whip your socks off, you put that cloth tape in the heel, and you're back in business. You can walk down the road 10, 15, 20 miles if you have to. Without that tape, you might be dead in the water a mile down the road. Next thing I have, this is something most people don't think about and don't have, is a colloidal silver generator. Now, one of the things I'll get into more detail later on is the bio threat. What does a colloidal silver generator do? It makes this kind of smoky-looking water, tiny particles of silver in there. Now, what that'll do is that silver will kill all known pathogenic bacteria. Any bacteria that's harmful to people, regardless of whether it's antibiotic resistant or not, that colloidal silver will take it down. And if you have to, you can get a nebulizer and you can inhale it to deal with antibiotic resistant tuberculosis or pneumonia affecting the lungs, and it will take it down. It will also deactivate viruses. So maybe some plague is going around. Maybe the hospitals are down and everyone's getting sick, and you know, it's everyone's getting sick. You have this colloidal silver generator. It's like having your own endless supply of antibiotics in your back pocket. You can not only purify water, you can also heal yourself, heal your family and friends for about 10 cents a day. Very important thing to have.
Hey, we'll talk about that more. Here's my question, though, Matt. You know, if it really hits the fan, if it's a long-term kind of a thing, and you know, society crumbles and everything is going to be down for a long time, doesn't this prolong the obvious, the inevitable, a grab-and-run kit that lasts you a couple of days?
Well, that's where the other skills in my book are so important, because my book covers everything from the minor meltdown to the major, you know, what's hit the fan and everything's fallen apart. So it's great to have the little MacGyver gadgets so that for the short term, they'll mean that you can be safe and healthy and relatively comfortable even if there's a short-term meltdown. Long-term meltdown means relying on skills, primitive living skills that people all over the world have used for millions of years, or certainly hundreds of thousands of years, to survive, and most of us in America have forgotten how to do those. So my book covers how you can make something to melt steel or aluminum, so you can cast metal from scratch. If you had to repair something, make a belt buckle, whatever. It shows you how to make shoes, you know, from tires, or how to tan leather and hides. It shows you how to, you know, what are the best bugs to eat if you had to. I live in Lake Tahoe near Donner Summit, where the Donner Party had their famous barbecue, you know, about 150 years ago. They got stuck in a horrendous winter. They didn't make it over Donner Summit, which is 10 miles from my house, and the snow piled up to a snowpack of almost 20 feet on the ground. Now, some of the families did fairly well and didn't actually have to eat mom and dad and our grandma who died, and some of the others did have to. But if they had known that you could strip the bark of most of the trees in the area, you know, the green layer, peel off the green layer just like starving deer do, and, you know, make kind of a meal out of that, pancakes even out of that if you had to, if they'd known that, then they wouldn't have had to resort to Aunt Jo and Mary Jane. So I give people the variety in my book. You know, I'm hoping it never comes down to that, but knowledge is power. And if you have this knowledge and you have these skills, then at whatever level it may be, whether it's a short-term meltdown, you got all the cool gadgets so you can weather it nicely and comfortably, or whether it's long-term and you have to live with more primitive living skills and fend for yourself, then having that knowledge and those skills on hand and having the mental attitude, the can-do attitude that says, I can do this, I can deal with this, I'm not going to fall apart, I'm going to just, you know, do the best I can for me and my family, and I've got the skills, so if I need to, I can live off the land and we'll do it.
Well, I agree with you, it's better to know than not know. I'm just thinking of, let's say, a worst-case scenario, any of these worst-case scenarios comes to fruition, and, you know, most Americans living in urban environments, they're not paying attention to this, they're not going to be ready. Even if you and your family are ready, it's going to hit the fan, isn't it? When people start getting hungry, it gets violent and nasty and break-ins and guns, and it's going to be ugly if it got to that point.
It does. You know, some people say, well, if I don't have my 5 acres and my off-grid home, you know, say I've got my 5 acres and off-grid home, you can say, well, yeah, I'm set. But then, like you say, somebody else may come along and say, well, I'm meaner and nastier and more well-armed, and I'm going to take it away from them. And that's where community is so important. You know, there's kind of two philosophies here. There's the lone wolf that says, I'm going to be meaner and tougher and better armed than the other guy, so they're going to leave me alone. Well, you know, that's a decent philosophy, I suppose. But then there's the other philosophy that says, it's in a community that the strength lies. It's just like in the old days. They had castles and they had communities for protection. People came into their community and they teamed up together, and they were strong against people who would, you know, raid lone people. You know, there were robbers that would come up, and if you were not traveling in a group, if you were not part of a community, then you were easy game and easy prey. And I believe that if things really come down, it will be like that. You'll have the best chance in a self-reliant community where people team up with strength and they can share materials, they can share skills, they can share knowledge, and they can watch each other's back. So I really believe the future is in community.
And that's one of the
self-reliant community.
So that's one of the suggestions you're making in getting ready for whatever is coming, is to cut a deal with people you know and trust, and people who have other skills maybe than you, and have a sort of a plan of action for if it hits the fan.
That's one thing. And the other possibility is, if you are on the road someday and you have a good set of skills and talents, then I think people will naturally pool together with others where they can share skills and talents and materials. And that's where being a likable person that can get along and has the skills and talents to share and offer something of value. So you'll find that there's people who have those communities where they stay in their community and they're fine. And you'll find that there's other people who leave the urban centers and gravitate and become a part of a community. You know, in times of turmoil, there's always been huge migrations of people, where people have hit the road and they've left. Like in the Middle Ages, when the plague hit, the cities became death traps. If you stayed in half of Europe died during these plagues, the Black Plague, in the medieval times. And if you stayed in the city, I think about 9 out of 10 people died in the cities. So basically, anyone you wanted to live, you had to leave the cities. You had to hoof it down the road. So if you have that resilience and skills and talents, you might do just fine. Even if you have no money, don't have your 5 acres, don't have your off-grid home, you've got those skills and talents, you hoof it down the road, and you meet similar people, and you team up, and you watch each other's back, and you do your best.
And do you have examples of where this has actually worked? That kind of thing has happened, and people have banded together and saved themselves?
Well, the medieval time, it certainly happened all over. The half of Europe that survived basically did that. They left the cities and they went to the country and they did that. And my own example is like my father-in-law. He was a poor Dutch citizen in World War II. He became a resistance fighter. He teamed up with other resistance people. He was captured and tortured by the Nazis and sentenced to death. He maintained this incredible, wonderful attitude all of his life. His favorite saying was, make you happy. He was always making jokes. He was a joy to be around. People loved being around this man. And he survived when everyone was dying around him, both first in World War II, and then he ended up being trained in America after Holland was liberated. He was trained as a Marine, and then the war in the Pacific was over, and the Indonesian Revolution broke out, so the Queen sent all of the Dutch people who'd been trained by America to fight in the war, which was now over, World War, sent them down to Indonesia to fight in the Indonesian Revolution. And most of the people he was with died, and he survived. So he had this sort of internal radar that guided him and protected him. He had this wonderful, positive attitude, and he never accepted defeat. He was sentenced to death. He was put in front of a firing squad 3 different times. They shot blanks at him, trying to break his spirit, trying to make him tell who other people were in the resistance. And he knew that if he broke, then he would sentence all of his friends and comrades to torture and death, just like he was facing. And on the day of his final execution, where they said, okay, this is it, we can't break this guy, He's sentenced to death in this puppet court, and we're going to really execute him this time. On that day, resistance fighters, they were a border town. They all spoke perfect German, the people he was working with, came in dressed in Nazi uniforms, said, "We're taking the prisoner to the yard. We're going to execute him." Brought him to the yard. He actually thought he was going to be executed. He didn't know the people until they got to the yard, and instead of shooting him, they helped him up over the wall, and he jumped down, broke both ankles, and was carried into a waiting car and taken away. So this is an example where people did the right thing. They didn't buy into the fear of Nazism and the evil of Nazis. They didn't buy in. They didn't become traitors and collaborators. And in spite of all odds appearing to be against them, they did the right thing, and they washed each other's back. And sure, yes, many of them died, but people like my father-in-law pulled through against all odds. And it's that spirit, that internal guidance, that not giving up, that's such a critical thing to surviving in a state where the world is in transition and things are falling apart. And that's one thing I try to help people develop in the book, too, is that kind of resilience and that kind of survivor personality and how to get in touch with that inner guide within all of us that can point us in the right direction and tell us what to do when our minds can't figure it out. You just can't figure it out. You don't have all the information at hand. And that's where that inner compass, that God-given survival tool that's been bred into people through millions of years of natural selection is so important.
You sort of had a kind of a survival adventure in writing this book, putting it all on the line kind of a thing. We're going to take a break in about 2 minutes, but maybe you can start that story.
Yeah, I definitely put it all on the line. It just about bankrupted me. But people say, well, why did you write this book? Are you a survivalist? Have you always been into this stuff? And I've had a practice of prayer and meditation for 30 years, and I was never a survivalist, what I called a survivalist, and would never dream of writing anything like this book. And back in 1997, roughly Thanksgiving, this is a time when .com was booming, business couldn't be better in America, and oil was at a 30-year low when you looked at, when you factored inflation in. It just seemed like everything was going great. And I prayed and asked for guidance and inspiration, just a generic request. It's not like I hear very much normally in my prayer and meditation. I got a semi-apocalyptic vision. I got a storyboard outline, about 20 pictures outlining the book from start to finish and what it was supposed to accomplish and what it was supposed to do in pictorial form, just like when they make those storyboards to outline the script of a movie, you know, the scheme of a movie, the plot of a movie.
Well, I'll tell
you
what,
on my book.
We need to take a break. We'll pick up that story when we come back, talking with Matthew Stein, author of When Technology Fails. And when we come back, we'll also get into the idea of food and how much you should put away for you and your family. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.